evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, fighting against sweatshops in New York City. But first, Supreme Court candidate Alito favored overturning Roe v. Wade and state-level barriers to reproductive rights with Kim Gandy, President, National Organization for Women.
Kim, we welcome you to Building Bridges.
Oh, it's so nice to be back with you again.
Indeed. And Kim, you are in a very well-situated position to give our audience a sense of the courts. And one of the things that I did want to look at, the question of almost an omnipotence of the Supreme Court, and yet there seems to be a lackluster response to a very, very dangerous nominee, Samuel Alito. If you can help us get a better sense of the importance of the court system and why we have to become more enmeshed in it and enmeshed indeed in the protest of the potential new justice of the Supreme Court, Samuel Alito.
You know, we learned in civics about the three branches of government, those three co-equal branches, the legislative branch, which is the House and the Senate, the executive branch, which is the presidency and the administration, and the judicial branch, which is the Supreme Court and the lower courts. And, of course, the president and the legislative and the executive branches have a co-equal job in selecting that third branch, the judicial. But once they've done that selection, once those people are on the Supreme Court, they are essentially omnipotent. And people, I think, really don't get that part. They don't realize that once you're on the Supreme Court, you don't answer to anybody. You're there for life. You essentially can't be removed. And from that point forward, the Supreme Court can undo anything the president does. The Supreme Court can undo anything the Congress does. If the Supreme Court decides they don't like the Voting Rights Act, out it goes. If they don't like the Violence Against Women Act, as in fact they did this with Title III of the Violence Against Women Act, they just tossed it out. If they decide that women shouldn't be able to use birth control, as was the case in this country with unmarried women until 1972, just before Roe v. Wade was decided, they could repeal that decision in Griswold versus Connecticut and make birth control unavailable simply by deciding to do it. And when I had a conversation with a senator not long ago, and he said, well, you know, one of the problems with Roberts, who is now the Chief Justice, was that he didn't really have much of a paper trail. He didn't have much of a record for us to judge him on, and therefore it was hard to oppose him. And I said, I thought that should make it hard to support him. If he doesn't have a record, if he doesn't have anything on which we can judge how he will hold our literal lives in his hands, how can we put him on that court? And that's our concern about Alito. He does have a paper trail. He has a record. And it's a long and terrible record on women's rights, on civil rights, on access to the courts, on access to justice, on just a broad range of issues. He has a very, very bad track record, not only of personal statements that he's made, but his writings and his court decisions. And to think that there's any question that our future would be put in his hands, his unfettered hands, his irrevocable, impossible to overturn hands, is really a frightening thought, and people just aren't getting it yet.
In 1989 through the early 1990s, there was the right to jury trials, including in the Civil Rights Act, et cetera. We looked at issues of sexual harassment and sexual discrimination relevant to the issue of jury trials. And I want you to take us back there and help us understand what a huge breakthrough that was in the workplace. And again, what we may lose, because there are real issues about the standards that the Supreme Court will use to make these adjudications about such important issues.
Sure. Back in 1989 and 90, we were getting through a piece of legislation called the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which for the first time granted a jury trial in cases of sex discrimination and sexual harassment. Prior to that time, and remember this was 1991, was 11 years into the first Reagan and Bush administration, so they'd had 11 years to stack the courts with very, very conservative judges like Sam Alito, who didn't believe in sex discrimination or sexual harassment cases. They basically seemed to think that employers should be able to do pretty much whatever they want and that all of this stuff is harmless. And so finally, we had a chance in sexual harassment and sex discrimination cases to go around the trial judge and go to take our case directly to the jury, something which had been available since 1963 for race discrimination cases, but not for sex discrimination cases. So finally, in 1991, it really changed the landscape to be able to have a jury trial on your claims so that an honest-to-goodness jury of your peers could look at what happened to you and make a judgment as to whether or not it was unlawful discrimination. But what happened then was that some judges decided to do what they could to make it hard to get your case in front of a jury. So they started setting up judicial barriers. Well, you have to have this kind of evidence before you're allowed present your case to the jury, or you have to have that kind of evidence, or you have to have this much more evidence. And then the judges began simply saying, well, you don't have enough evidence, I'm not going to let you go to the jury. And Sam Alito has been one of those who has been just extraordinary in his reluctance or unwillingness to let not just sex discrimination cases, but race discrimination cases as well get to a jury. In other words, he sets up new and unique and creative barriers that keep women and people of color from ever getting a chance to prove their case. Not that he rules against you after you've proved, after you've put on your evidence. He doesn't even let you get there. Fortunately, he has been in the minority in most of those cases and heavily criticized by the other judges who ruled differently with a majority opinion. And he was in the dissent saying, I disagree. I think the test should be harder. I don't think they should have been able to get this case to the jury, etc. But on the Supreme Court, he could very well form a majority with some of the other ultra-conservatives that are already on the court, like Roberts and Thomas and Scalia, for taking us back before these civil rights laws gave us the right to a jury trial and effectively undo our right to a jury trial by setting the barrier so high that no one can reasonably overcome it.
Kim, unfortunately, I think we're just sort of getting a sample of how important this is, but you'd said before, people just don't get it. Now has been in the forefront of opposition to Alito. What do other organizations need to do? What do the Democratic Party need to do? What can people do at this point?
I have to say that if there was ever a time for the Democrats and the Senate and the Republican moderates to step forward and say enough is enough, this is the time. If they're not going to do it now, if they're not going to do it on Sam Alito, who is the fifth vote, he's replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, who's been the swing vote on affirmative action, on reproductive rights, on family and medical leave, on just case after case after case where she was the swing vote on the court, replacing her with somebody like Sam Alito as the swing vote, well, it's no more swing vote. You know where he's going to swing. He's going to be on the same side every time, and there's no more swing vote. We start losing these cases right and left, and the senators know that, and some of the senators like that idea. Some of the really conservative Republicans say, great, that's what we need. We need a solid conservative majority on the Supreme Court that's going to undo some of this craziness that Congress has passed, like the Voting Rights Act, for example. But those who are on our side, this is it. This is the time for them to step up and say, wait a minute, this is the Supreme Court. This isn't a game. This isn't something where George Bush just gets to name anybody he wants. We have a job here. We have a co-equal role as one of the other two branches of government in choosing the third branch, and we're going to exercise our right to say that we don't want somebody with this kind of judicial philosophy on that court, period.
And how can people find out more about what is to be done, get in touch with the National Organization for Women, and step up the pressure to make sure there is not the confirmation of Samuel Alito?
Absolutely. And talk with your senators. Make sure, even though you might assume that your senators are taking the right position, virtually no senators have come out actively opposed to Alito. Lots of them have come out in his favor, but so far no one has come out opposed. We think that a number will, but will it be enough? And, you know, I have to say, as someone who has heard many times, oh, well, you have to vote for so-and-so. I know that, you know, that he's not really much better than the one that's in there, but you have to vote for him because, after all, think about the Supreme Court. Well, how many years have we heard that? And here we are. It is now Judgment Day. Will it have made a difference or not? And if those folks who wanted our votes, who said we're going to stand up for the rights of individuals over corporations and businesses, we're going to stand up for the environment, we're going to stand up for civil rights and women's rights, it's only talk unless they really put it into action right now when it counts. It has never, never been more important.
We thank very much Kim Gandy, the president of the National Organization for Women, a trial lawyer, and I urge you to go to NOW's website to find out what you can do. Kim, thank you.
It's just my pleasure always.
Well, we're switching gears just a bit, and we are very pleased to have with us Jay Fong, who is with the Chinese Staff and Workers Association. And John Antush is a member of the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops and Justice Will Be Served campaign. And we have a lot of things to talk about. The Golden Bridge restaurant has a blacklist.
Yes, hi.
What are they up to and why do they maintain a blacklist and against who, John?
The Golden Bridge restaurant, it's located down at 50 Bowery near the corner of Canal where the New Silver Palace used to be. And the reason why they have a blacklist there, we're picketing there 3 days a week. And it's very important because over the years, workers picketed and fought at many different restaurants, Silver Palace, Jing Fong, New Silver Palace, and won improvements in many restaurants in the community where there used to be 70 hours a week and less than minimum wage, even in some cases, less than 90 cents an hour. Because workers stood up and fought for changes, now many restaurants comply with minimum wage and have a 40-hour work week. However, 1 year ago when Golden Bridge opened, since that time they've refused to interview even one union worker. Over 40 members of the 318 Restaurant Workers Union have applied, and they have systematically discriminated against them, made anti-union statements in the press, even made threats towards people. They're trying to intimidate women and men for being part of a union. So that's why there's a blacklist there, trying to blacklist any worker, really, who stood up.
We're going to get back to that, but we also want to bring in now, because it's all really tied in and there's an alliance that's been formed here, which is terrific, and that is the question of Liberty Apparel. Jay Fong, you're going to tell us about subcontracting and Liberty Apparel and Conway and what's going on.
Yeah, I just wanted to contrast what's been going on with Chinatown restaurants and Chinatown garment factories in New York. While in the past 15 years, restaurant industry conditions have really improved to 40-hour work weeks and decent wages.
Thanks in no small part to the Chinese Staff and Workers Association.
Largely because of the picket and the militant workers that have come out and refused to let the bosses cut down on their organizing. In the garment industry, you had what was at times unionized sweatshops, where sometimes even the union organizers were acting as sort of almost subcontractors. So in the past 20 years, garment factories, conditions have gotten so much worse to the point where workers are working 140 hours a week, still at piece rate wages. And, you know, it's largely accepted that it's due to globalization, that factories are going overseas to China and Mexico. But what we've seen is garment factories are shifting to, you know, Midtown or across the street in Chinatown or into Brooklyn. They're working three people's jobs, 140 hours a week. You could employ three different people for the same amount of work. So we see it's largely due to subcontracting that, as we see in the case of Liberty Apparel, it's really highlighted how manufacturers are denying responsibility to their subcontracted workers, trying to say that they don't have control over these workers conditions when, in fact, they have quality control people in there every single day, clamping down on workers, making them work faster and harder, and controlling exactly the amount of money that the subcontracted factory is getting. So we're asking for a boycott of Liberty Apparel, but not only a consumer boycott, but we're also asking the retailers who are contracting with Liberty to stop selling Liberty and stop contracting. So now we've sent letters to Conway, Rainbow Apparel, Rainbow Fashions, Family Dollar, Fashion Sense, all the main retailers that we've seen are selling Liberty. And those retailers that refuse to honor our boycott, we're asking for a boycott of those retailers. So a big one, I mean, Conway is one of the largest sort of low-end chains in New York City. So we're going to be out there every single day.
You hear that,
people,
Conway?
To boycott Conway.
Get ready. Actually, you don't have to be out there, because if Conway just sees its evil ways, you won't have to be out there. But I'm sure one way or the other, you're going to force them to. And I'm also interested, just for a moment, about you, Jay Fong. Why did you get involved in this particular area of organizing? What stimulated you?
I've had a sort of a long history with groups here and there, but
long history, yeah, at least 30, 40 years.
Right, in my old age. But it's really sort of the perspective that all of the theories of Chinese staff really come from working people and their experiences and how they sum up to really see that the system, it can't be reformed. It can't be molded or changed little by little. That really, it's the working class, the working people of this country really need to come together and really overturn the whole system on its head. And there's no other way to do that. I mean, I guess we see, you know, with a lot of different cases, there are all these ways that people are divided in this country. Like, I mean, especially in Liberty Apparel, like people, you know, working people shop there all the time because it's cheap clothes. And, you know, they kind of feel like, you know, they have a right to buy clothes, but it's an ingenious way that bosses and management and even our government is complicit in pitting people against each other when they actually have a lot more in common.
Along those lines, I mean, one reason why the Liberty Apparel case is very important, it's an example of undocumented and citizens coming together to fight against slave-like working conditions. We see these this division between citizens and undocumented workers also in the service industries. I mentioned before, where I was introduced also as being part of the Justice Will Be Served campaign. In this Justice Will Be Served campaign, it's a campaign of service workers who've been standing up against very bad conditions, similar to those in Liberty Apparel, in restaurants, delis, and other workplaces. And what we've seen is that this division between citizens and undocumented workers is very pernicious, and we feel that it is the result of the employer sanctions law, which we see as a modern slave law, in fact, putting aside undocumented workers as a separate caste or class, underclass of workers, where employers will employ them for, have to employ them under illegal conditions, and there's a demand for that employment or for substandard conditions. And so now, fortunately, in cases like Liberty Apparel, but also in restaurants like Bay Plaza Restaurant, Zen Palette, actually, workers are coming forward and taking on these conditions. And we see them not only trying to join unions, but also using the courts, using many different methods to fight back. And it's growing, fortunately. So we hope that everyone will support both the Liberty Apparel case, Golden Bridge Picket, and there's also a strike going on out in East Buffet Restaurant in Huntington, New York, out in Long Island, where workers were working 65 hours a week, getting as little as $1 an hour. And when they stood up for themselves, they were harassed.
An hour.
Yes.
I want to say that again. $1 an hour.
Right, and that's why we're what we're talking about.
You say right. I'm still like $1 an hour.
Yeah, no,
good
it's
it really sucks when you get a check for $67 for your whole week. You know, you spent the whole week working.
And the management there also, you know, stole tips. So these conditions are actually very common right now. The only way we feel that they're going to be solved is if workers come together, whether they're undocumented or whether they're citizens. And this is a concrete way that people can stand up against employer sanctions and support the abolition of these slave-like conditions.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I had said about the transit strike, for many people, it not only brought the issue of strike and labor home, but it did so because it immediately inconvenienced people. So it had a dramatic and real impact on their lives. Well, we have these schisms between people as consumers who go to the Walmarts and say they want bargains and forget about the exploitation of the labor, very often 10 and 13-year-old kids in the world community shoved into sweatshop prisons that are making the clothes, and the exploitation and discrimination of the workers here that are forced to sell them. How do you begin to bridge those gaps between people who would eat at the restaurants you're talking about, John, people who would go into the Conway's, which I shop in Conway, buy the Liberty apparel clothes, begin to make people see that there's a responsibility, there's a correlation between wanting cheap goods but not accepting the exploitation and vicious, vicious conditions that are impacting on the workers?
Well, I think one thing that we've seen is that since this employer sanctions law was passed in 1986, there has been a growing demand for these undocumented workers to work under these horrific conditions. And I think that it does have an impact. And the first way we've tried to overcome that is in these workplaces, for these workers to find their common ground. Very often in the same workplace, you'll have a citizen working next to an undocumented worker. And often the citizen may feel that the undocumented worker is undermining them and will blame them. And what we're trying to do is expose that common ground, that it is the same exploitation we're facing. In addition, in our organizing, in the Justice Will Be Served campaign, we're involving all kinds of people. I myself am a high school teacher. There are many office workers and other people who've been involved in the campaign. And we're seeing that these kinds of conditions, longer work hours, deteriorating health conditions, other things like that, really do are spreading through the economy. And in addition, in the Liberty Apparel case, there's the added dimension of the subcontracting, which, of course, you know, used to be mainly just in the garment industry, this so-called sweating system in the garment industry. But now it's spread to office workers, maintenance workers, you name it.
Yeah, I just want to jump in here and say, we also look, and not just at sort of concrete conditions like minimum wage, but also the fact that people, office workers, are working like 60 plus hours a week.
Yeah, and that's normal. Bring back the 8-hour day, huh?
Right. That's given. So people always look to other people. You know, it's so much worse for these undocumented workers when they don't see what they're, you know, what they're facing themselves. So we try to bring that to light, kind of the fact that it's not just about, you know, how much money you're paid or what the minimum wage is, what the living wage is considered, because that kind of, it's, you know, it changes. You know, what you can live on in New York is not the same in, you know, in Mississippi. But it's really about control. Like, workers don't have control of their own time and their own lives, and their health is not valued. And those are really the things that we're fighting to change.
Jaefeong, you remind me of yesterday I played a piece by Martin Luther King. It was his last speech from the mountaintop, which was delivered to a congregation in Memphis, where he was telling people that they had to relate to the sanitation, the striking sanitation workers in Memphis, because it was relating to themselves that the conditions of exploitation immiserate all of us. And it's not so much what we do for ourselves, but it is that kind of one world theory that there but for I go, and that we have a collective obligation to ourselves, to the community, to the one world, to enhance the condition under which people work. We will continue to look at these issues, and we really want people who were in many ways enamored by the drama of the recent transit strike and the eloquence of the leadership of Roger Toussaint to take these struggles that you've been discussing as seriously and immerse themselves in supporting it. So the critical question is, John, give us the names of the restaurants and also information about where we can go to get websites, etc. And Jaefeong, yourself as well, we want to know where that picket line is.
I'm going to give you that information. I just wanted to add that these pickets and these leafleting and these activities are concrete ways that people can really challenge this whole issue of exploitation of undocumented workers and the existence of this slave underground. You can also look at www.nmass.org. NMASS.org.
You can go from the restaurant to Conway's, and you've got to tell all these institutions they'd better treat the workers right. We need living wages. We need benefits. We need contracts. Stop messing with our pension funds when we have it. Stop messing with our health benefits. Okay, John, I can see you're chomping at the bit.
I just wanted to add that right now a lot of liberals are supporting the strengthening of employer sanctions, tailing after President Bush. But this is an example where by supporting workers, we can really, really get to the root of the problem and hopefully change things.
And as Jay Fong said, really change things from the bottom up structurally. Jay Fong with the Chinese Staff and Workers Association and John Antouche, who arranged this segment for us with the National Mobilization Against Sweatshop. Thank you. We'll continue to look at these issues.
Thank you, Mimi.
Thanks, Mimi.
And this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And you can reach us at knash@igc.org. That's knash@igc.org.
I believe in myself and I must get paid. So I'm down with the union so I won't get paid.
So what side are you on?
I think the answer's simple.
So what side are you on?
Yo, I'm down for my people.
I believe in the workers. I keep the city together. I believe in the union. Solidarity for us.
That's Sister Paula Bamba from Canada asking which side are you on?